This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. The weather guys are back with us today. Steve Ackerman is the former Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison. He's also an emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And John Martin is a professor and former chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. And we'd like to hear from you. What weather questions or observations would you like to talk about? Give us a call. 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, Steve, it's good to see you. John is a little AWOL.
Yeah, he'll be here, I'm
he'll
sure.
He'll be here a
teaching
later.
Class. This is the thing with people who have real jobs.
That's right. Said as a true retiree.
Right.
I love it. So I think the thing that's on most people's minds is, it's almost December and tomorrow's going to be like 80 degrees. What's going on?
Yeah. You know, October's been a dry and warm month in general. It's not uncommon to have this, although it's not common either. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we had, last week we had some frost around town. I'm an outside of town.
Yeah.
And yeah, later on this week, it's going to get up in the 70s for sure. And it's going to be, on Wednesday or so, it'll be stormy and rainy. Mm-hmm. But then it goes back into the warm. It's just part of the extremes that we're seeing as we warm up as a globe as well. Those warm extremes are going to get warmer. And that's part of the variability that we're seeing as well.
I like it in the fall and the spring. I'm not sure I'm going to like it in the summer, but
Don't like it in the summer. And the humidity in the summer also adds to the uncomfort. But right now, blue skies, beautiful. The leaves are really, in some areas, are really peaking right now. And so it's really nice to get out.
Depending on where you live. I'm down here in the south end of Wisconsin. It's beautiful.
There are some really gorgeous trees out there right now. Yep. Yeah, we were up north a little earlier in the week. And a lot of that, it's already
Hit
its
the
peak.
Ground. Yeah. But it's gorgeous. We did get an email from Krista earlier. She called to ask how unusual it is to have such visible northern lights as we've seen recently, because there's been all kinds of alerts and they were amazing.
Unfortunately, it's not unfortunate because we were further south, but hiking in the Arches and Badlands and things like that. So it was beautiful down there. But the Northern Lights didn't get there. And it is odd to be seeing such beautiful displays in southern Wisconsin as we've been seeing. There's a couple of things that go along with that. What causes these gorgeous northern lights to reach this far are mass ejections of the sun, the corona mass ejections. And those are occurring frequently. It's just a question of, does it hit Earth? And so the sun, in terms of its activity, goes through an 11-year cycle or a 22-year cycle to complete it. And it's coming out of an active year. It's just reached its peak when we had the solar eclipse a couple of years ago. So it's still near its peak in activity. And the question is, does that corona mass injection hit Earth or not? And a lot of times, you get the alert that it's happening and you get your fingers crossed that it's going to hit us, and it doesn't. And so you don't have it. This past cycle was, we got some really gorgeous.
And I tried really hard to go and find it. I don't know what it was. I just have some kind of a doom cloud over my head or something. All these people were taking these beautiful pictures and I'm outside looking and I couldn't find any. So when we have these, is it pretty spotty?
It can be spotty, but not so much because it is a big event. Geographically, longitudinally, it can be a really big event. The question is, one, is it cloudy or not? Because it is, even though the pictures look gorgeous, it is faint still, right? And you got to think about how they're taking the pictures. They probably have their shutter open for a while in order to intensify it.
Very true.
And then the other thing is, are you out there at the right time? So a lot of times you'll go out there at midnight and it won't really hit until 1 a.m. And if you fall asleep in your lounge chair, you're going to miss it.
Unless that mosquito bites you.
True, right? Yeah.
So those little, I keep getting notifications from, I don't remember even who, telling me, what time it's going to be. You can see these northern lights or what have you. Are those pretty accurate?
They are. What I subscribe to is, it's the Space Association. It's a government agency. I forget what it is, but I get emails as well when there's a mass ejection. So as soon as they observe the sun sending out another corona mass ejection, you know, they send out an alert and they tell you if it's minor, major, or in between, and what the probability if it's going to hit Earth. So that's what I subscribe to. And if it's a major one with a high probability, then I pay attention. I'm sure there are other sites that give you the timing and things like that, but I don't subscribe to those.
Okay, I see a map, and it's the globe, and it just, you know, has the colors about where it'll be covering.
And that's where, again, when I get that message that there's a major one, then I'll start looking, okay, is it going to hit northern Wisconsin, or does it look like it's going to come down here?
Yeah.
And then I'll follow up.
So we did kind of get off on that, so thank you for the question.
Well, it's space weather. It's still weather.
But we want to talk about, of course, we're talking about the warm fall, but it's been so dry, too. Now, you said we're going to... I see the predictions too. We're going to get a little rain this week, but what about the next few weeks? Are we just in one of those cycles where it's dry?
It certainly seems that way. I haven't looked out beyond into November to see what's going on in November. I've been more focusing in October, where we have been a really dry spell. I'm part of this COCAROS, which is a community that makes observations of rainfall at home. And I'd say probably 20 days in October, we didn't have any precipitation. There was one day where I had 4 inches early on in October, but ever since then, it's been at most a tenth of an inch or a trace, but not, it's been just dry.
It has.
And you can see it when you go outside.
Oh, yeah. I can't believe I'm still watering flowers the end of October. I'm not complaining about that.
I'm not happy about that either. and we had this prediction of a little bit of rain a couple of days ago, which was great. But the ground was so dry that I actually watered our flowers as well in order to make it susceptible so that that little bit of rain we had absorbed.
Yeah, exactly. Are we setting any records? Do you know?
Oh, that is a good question that I should have looked up for October. I except for that really big day where we had a few inches across the state, I would think that probably is keeping us from being one of the record precipitations in October.
Because that was kind of a big dump. So.
That was just a big dump, I know, you know, most places in southern Wisconsin got around 1.5 to 2 inches. Our house was one of those areas where we got 4 inches of rain.
According to our producer Joel here, State Climatology Office says that by the end of September, 16% of the state, including northern and south central Wisconsin, will experience moderate drought conditions.
That I believe.
And it's probably gotten worse.
And it's gotten worse. Yeah. Now, what that is in terms of the driest or not, I don't know where it ranks, but we're definitely in a drought situation.
Yeah. What is that going to mean if we don't have a wet winter?
I mean, you'll be watering your flowers even more.
Right? Well, I could have figured that out, Steve. Does that usually mean if we've got all this dry, 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 is that going to continue for a while?
It depends on the kind of cycle that we get into.
Okay.
And so in the wintertime, you know, we could really wipe this out with, again, a couple of really good winter storms, which are not uncommon in Wisconsin.
Yeah, they could happen any time.
We certainly have experienced that.
Yes, we have. Yeah. Yes, we have.
And I think the real danger, again, we can water our plants to some degrees unless it's a real severe drought, then we shouldn't. But the key will be in forests and the prairie lands. They'll be dry and therefore really susceptible to fires.
And we did have a winter last year with not a lot of precipitation.
We did, that's right, which helped lead to the dry. It made it up in the spring and early summer.
Yeah.
But then, we're back in that dry period.
We're back in that again. What about winter forecasts? Have you seen anything? Do we have an El Nino?
I haven't looked at it. It's not, I don't like to go too far out. I mean, the forecasts are getting really good
now.
But I kind of still head, I don't want to be looking at December or January yet in terms of what it's looking like.
Right, right. Well, if John was here, we could ask him what the Farmer's Almanac says. For those who don't know, John does not like the Farmer's Almanac prediction.
They'll tell you whatever they said opposite.
Opposite, right, just to be stubborn about it. So, we're joined today by Steve Ackerman, an emeritus professor of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. If you've got a question about the weather or have an observation, give us a call. Lines are open, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. Hope you can join us tomorrow. We're going to be talking about growing pumpkins, big ones, little ones, the ones in between, and also carving them with a master carver. And then in the second hour, we're going to hear about the best ways to learn a foreign language. So that's tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show, starting at 11. Right now, it is weather time. So we're talking to John, well, actually to Steve. John is on his way, we assume. he'll be getting here at some point. Either way, we can handle this, Steve. So, you know, you guys write this really great column. Is it weekly?
It is. Okay. We've been doing it weekly since 2011 or something.
Oh, my gosh. It's called Ask the Weather Guys, appropriately enough, and it's a Wisconsin State Journal. But a couple of weeks ago, your column answered the question about our they, in quotation marks, really controlling the weather, and who is they in that question?
Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of conspiracy theories out there right now.
About everything.
We had a representative from another state claim that we are controlling the weather, which is just baloney. I mean, we can't. We are impacting climate, but again, that is something that has been occurring for many, many years through slow changes in the chemical composition of the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. There is so much energy associated with a storm that we just don't have that kind of energy, even if we knew how to control the weather. So, no, we cannot control the weather. If we did, we wouldn't really be in a dry drought condition in Wisconsin. We're not evil people who are trying to control the world.
No, not at all.
It's unfortunate that people think that.
But it really is unfortunate. I'm sorry, I lost my place here. Healing the ozone hole. So we were talking about that in the promo about. Okay, I thought the ozone hole had been closed, so apparently I have not been up to date on this. What's going on with that?
So it's getting better, for sure. And again, this is one of those examples where unintentionally we're changing the environment chemically through CFCs that are very stable chemicals that we were using in refrigeration back in the 60s and 70s. And back in the 70s, it was discovered that they were very stable compounds, that they would make it up to the stratosphere where the ozone was and then break apart and interact with the oxygen atoms and prevent the formation of ozone or on the other hand, destroy the ozone shield up there, which protects us from ultraviolet radiation from the sun, which if you have fair skin, you know that that's a problem in terms of skin cancer and things like that. Mm-hmm. So that was back in the 70s. Again, there was a lot of discussion about what to do and could we do nothing. There was a lot of opposition to changing that because whether or not it was really the situation, et cetera. But eventually, the scientific evidence came through to demonstrate, yes, it is the CFCs. We began to change and make rules about using CFCs and finding other ways to cool refrigerants than using CFCs. And as a result, the ozone hole, as it was developing, is now slowing down. And so we're seeing the amount of ozone up in the stratosphere recuperating from those days.
So about that same time, people were talking about aerosols.
Yes.
Did that have an effect on the ozone too?
So part of that was also the aerosols finding their way up into the stratosphere and leading to a global cooling, again, because of the stability. And so they would reflect solar energy out. In fact, I think that may have been one of the things people were proposing in order to deal with the destruction of the ozone. And actually, people are now also proposing that in order to offset global warming. But that aside, that was another big thing in the 70s of how we deal with those aerosol sprays, mm-hmm. some of which had CFCs in them as well.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So I can kind of go back to using all that hairspray now.
and part of that is, you know, they changed how they do that activity. And, you know, there's always going to be unexpected consequences of what we're doing, that we're just, you know, ignorant of how something potentially works. And the key, I think, in this situations with CFC in the ozone hole is that we discovered the scientific evidence pointed to this is what's happening. And because of that, then socially and through regulations, we can deal with it and fix it. And it's the same thing with global warming. We know what's doing it. It's carbon emissions. And so the scientific evidence is there. We can't control the weather, but we can control how much carbon dioxide we put into the atmosphere or take out of the atmosphere. And that again, is going to take social responsibility to do that.
Sure. And it's a different time politically.
It's a very different time politically.
And if we had had the problem that we do now, back then, we might even have a bigger problem.
Ozone. Yes, I think if we had this political environment back in the 70s, it would have been really hard to deal with the issues with CFCs.
For sure.
It was hard to deal with to begin with.
Yes.
But now we seem to be in a situation where people just ignore science, and that we really can't do that. You can't just ignore data.
Exactly.
It's going to lead it to a problem.
It certainly is. And the whole global community came together for it.
And
for
that's true, too, right, because it was a global problem.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with global warming.
Now.
It's a global problem, and people need to get together and solve it.
Yeah. We did have a question from Wendy. She sent us an email. Many years ago, maybe 10 to 15, she had heard a report that Wisconsin weather would eventually be like Missouri, which I think we've heard that before. Is that what's happening now?
There was, I think it was about 10 to 15 years ago. And even now, although I don't see the map so much, in order to get the message across about what weather is going to be like due to global warming, they were looking at, okay, it's states to the south of us. Mm-hmm. What's their weather like? And so they would say, yeah, we're going to be, our average temperatures in wintertime are going to go up. We're not going to have as much snow. And therefore, we're going to look like this particular state. I think that was a good public message to get across.
Mm-hmm.
But the global warming is occurring, and maybe our mean temperature will be like Missouri. But the difference is geographically, we are different. And that will impact what our weather is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're bordered by two very large water bodies, Lake Superior and Lake Michigan. And that influences what our weather looks like. I think it's a good example to demonstrate to people, particularly if you don't like Missouri weather, which I don't, not during the summertime. Nothing against Missouri, but I don't like hot, humid weather. And that's kind of where we're trending to. And we're seeing that now in the summertime up here. It gets hot and humid.
Yes, for sure. Yeah. So that's kind of a little bit. But So we're having a few problems with our phone lines today, and I apologize to that. We had a whole new system put in last week. But I think we got them fixed now, so fingers crossed. You can always send us an email, too, if you're not being able to get through, and that's talk@wpr.org. Let's talk a little bit about Doppler radar, okay? So we all know about it getting precipitation and stuff, but it picks up other things, too, doesn't it?
It does, and it's really interesting when it does pick it up. Particularly for me personally, what I like is when the birds are migrating again.
Right.
And so in the evening, or bats as well, in the evenings when they're either coming in or early mornings when they're taking off, the radar can picks them up and you could actually see them.
Isn't that crazy?
Moving out. It's really crazy and interesting.
Yeah.
I think the other thing that's interesting to me anyway is, we have these sea breezes and lake breezes for us coming off of Lake Michigan.
Yeah.
And a lot of times on hot, humid days, when that lake breeze comes inland, it takes all that humidity and pushes it to the west. And you could see that lake breeze front on radar as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
Like my app, you can be doing like wind or you can do in precipitation. Is that the Doppler doing that too?
There are Doppler winds, but those aren't really used for the precipitation type activity.
Okay.
They're being used more and more. They were originally used for radar, not radar, for research type of activities. But yeah, most of the, and so my guess is, what the apps, at least that I have seen, where you're looking at wind and wind predictions, those are for models situations. So they're taking current data and either forecasting or using that data to turn it into a wind map.
I would like to know how the first person who saw that the birds on the radar reacted to that.
I would imagine they would have said, what is that?
What is that? Oh, my God.
One of the things you can see in the Milwaukee radar, just north of it, there's a wind farm. And so on beautiful clear days, you can see this radar signal from that wind farm.
Wow.
Now, they have methodologies to remove it, but it doesn't always work. And so some days you can look and you say, wow, why is it raining just there? And the answer is it's not. It's just they got the windmills going and you can pick them up.
Oh, that's interesting. We did have a message from Christopher. He said, our climate disruption is changing weather patterns worldwide, and now we see it here at home. We need to triple down on reducing our greenhouse gas emissions and plant trees and grasses to absorb carbon. We can make the difference. We need to act now, and there is nothing to chuckle about here, and the August weather in October is not nice. Okay. Well, Christopher's not happy with us being happy with this weather.
Yeah. And I could see, you know, the point he's making, which we talked a little bit with the ozone, is that we know that this is a problem. The data is showing that we are warming. And if we're going to do something about it, we have to do something as a society and a global society. We need to work together to figure out whether it's planting more trees. What the trees are doing, though, is storing it. So when the trees die, they're going to release it as well. So the question is, what are the activities that we need to do in order to kind of slow this down or stop it, if we can stop it?
And did I read right, too, that the warmer temperatures melting like the ice caps, and that's releasing more carbon also?
And, that is a big issue now that we're really seeing that up on the ice sheets. I mean, for one, we've noticed that on the Great Lakes or in the local lakes here in Madison. The ice on time period is reduced. But what we're seeing now is the glaciers are melting. Their predictions on Greenland is covered with an ice sheet. Antarctica is covered with an ice sheet. And as those melts, we're seeing the Antarctic ice sheet melt away. If those continue to melt, there's a lot of land underneath there as well. And that land's going to come up. And again, that'll then also have impacts on the ocean circulations and the sea level height as well when all that land pushes up. So we got issues here that our great-grandchildren are going to have to be dealing with, and we need to try to find ways to
get them ready. What are some of your favorite sources for information on all this climate change?
I usually go right to NOAA. So the NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, does have climate sites that you can go and get climate data from. They're a very trustworthy organization to get not just current data, which I think a lot of people probably go after. National Weather Service is part of that. So if you're looking at radar data, again, that's kind of the areas where it's coming from. And so that's where I typically will go and do the red maps.
Do you have
now
to be...
for weather climate in Wisconsin? I go to the Wisconsin State Climate Office. That's a lot faster data, and it's very specific for what's happening in Wisconsin.
So Wisconsin
today.
State Climate Office.
Yeah.
Is that what they're, I mean, should we just Google it?
You can Google it, and, it'll come up. Steve Vavris is the director here at UW-Madison. And Ed Hopkins is my favorite go-to guy when I have a climate question or a weather question about Wisconsin. I just email him and just say, what's happening here?
Yeah, that's nice to have him in your email list.
It is. And he's again, very good and knowledgeable. He's been around for a while.
Yeah. Again, I apologize. We are having phone problems, but we'd love to hear what your question or observation is. So maybe you can send us an email. That's talk@wpr.org. So there's always been this, I don't know if it's a myth or if it's true, but when it was thunderstorming out and I want to take a shower, my mom's like, no, do not take a shower during a thunderstorm. Is that a myth or is that something we should be concerned about?
It's a little bit of both.
Okay.
Before I go into the explanation, I will say this, even though I know my house pretty well, when it's thunderstorming out, I'm not going to take a shower. Now, the probability of getting hit, I mean, the issue back when our grandparents were telling us this,
yes,
is there were a lot of pipes, metal pipes, copper pipes. And it was possible that the house gets struck, even though it's unlikely, mm-hmm. Probability is low. If it does, then it can travel around through those pipes in the house. And if you're nearby, you can get hit, you know, as a secondary effect.
Yeah.
Whether or not it would kill you, maybe not, but you would get a really nasty shock. Today's modern houses, they don't use so much copper anymore because it's expensive, and mm-hmm. so they have plastic. And so, you know, again, the probability is less than. The probability has also gone down, I think, because when I was growing up, when you had wanted to watch TV and get a good signal, you needed to have an antenna on your house, and that was made of metal as well.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, everybody had one in the neighborhood, and so which house it would hit or which antenna, you know, again, there's a fraction of chance there.
Right. Same thing with phone lines, right?
And phone lines as well. Anything in metal, I mean, it can do it. When I was teaching, I had a student in class when we were talking about lightning. And him and his granddad were laying fence, which means they were putting down barbed wire fencer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, they could hear thunder, but it was way off. And the next thing he knew, him and his granddad were on the ground. They got knocked out. And what they concluded, and they were okay, but what they concluded is, you know, it hit the barbed wire fence a mile away, and it just traveled down the fence, and they were holding it, and it's happened.
Wow, the chances of that.
The chances of that are small, but mm-hmm. We, actually, speaking of small chances, have a tree that we have to take down because it has some fungus, and it's a cottonwood tree, and it may spread to the other ones, you know, so it was like, okay, we got to take this down. It's scheduled to come down sometime in November, but about a month ago, it got hit by lightning.
Wow.
Now, it's still standing, and I was at, you know, the window looking out at the storm when it got hit. And boy, I'll tell you, you know, if you haven't had lightning bolts hit close to you, boy, was that a noise and a power. And it,
yes,
you know, it exploded part of the tree. The tree's still together, but you really see the power in those lightning bolts.
Yeah, it's scary when it hits. And then it's like, they say it's ozone in the air. Is that what it is?
You get a smell like that,
yes,
that gets equated to it. Mm-hmm. I didn't go outside.
know, probably
I was
wise
just like,
on your part.
I was shocked about two things. One is that it hit the tree while I was looking. And of all the cottonwoods, it hit the one that we had to take down anyway. So,
someone up there likes you.
Somebody, right, yes.
Maybe. I don't know. Or their aim is off. One of the two.
Right.
Dean emailed us. He said, if you're missing winter, winter is coming tomorrow to him in Colorado. His question is about Milton, the hurricane, I'm assuming. Have you ever seen a hurricane develop in the Western Caribbean Sea and go northeast? What happened to hurricanes forming in the easterly waves from Africa and moving west with easterly waves?
Yeah, I didn't really track Milton. As he's pointing out, easterly waves are waves that travel around the globe in the tropical regions,
mm-hmm.
and hurricanes form in those areas and are also follow the transportation of those waves because of the divergence upper levels that allows the hurricane to develop. But I'm not sure where Milton went. So sorry about that.
Yeah. So with the global weather changes, what does that mean for big storms like the ones we just saw?
That is a really good question. What we're seeing in the big storms, there are two things that come to my mind. One is the the hurricanes, the tropical storms as well. What we're seeing in the terms of rapid intensification, which we've seen with some of these storms, particularly the recent ones that got to Florida and North Carolina, the water. One of the keys you need is to have warm water. Sea surface temperatures are warm, and we certainly have that with global warming, and that's allowing them to develop quicker. Because the other thing is, it's just not the surface water that needs to be warm. In these situations, the depth of that warmth is getting to depth, so that as the storm develops and the winds pick up and begin to mix that water up, it's not pulling down cooler water from below. It's still pulling up that 26.5 degree temperatures as well that help feed the hurricane.
And with like the Gulf Stream getting warmer, is that going to mean possibly that hurricanes are going to be hitting further up north?
We still get hurricanes up north for sure, right. Or they break down and become extratropical storms and get pretty nice, pretty neat, mean. The question, I think, with the Gulf Stream goes back to Greenland. As that ice sheet melts, you know, it's feeding into where the Gulf Stream goes. And so what will happen to the Gulf Stream is that water, cold water, comes in. And how does that change its path? And will that affect the path of the of storms that might follow normally along the Gulf Stream?
Sure. Yeah. Let's see. I'm not getting any emails, people. If you got any questions, give us a call. Oh, don't give us a call. It's not working.
That's right.
But send us an email, talk@wpr.org. What else have you been...
The other thing with regard to storms and global warming, that this would be a question for John because it's his area of expertise, is these mid-latitude cyclones, these winter storms.
Right.
And so part of those winter storms is they're trying to erase these temperature gradients between the north and the south. And so as we warm up, those temperature gradients are going to go further north. So how that affects the development of these mid-latitude cyclones that we get, I'm not sure about, but John would know when we could speak a question for next next month.
For next time, because he's obviously not coming now. So
yeah, something's gone on. I'm a little worried about it.
Thanks,
but,
John.
Yeah.
So I think next time you should probably just not show up, Steve.
Right, you know, yes, that's right.
Well, yeah. You know, something I'm always curious about is rain gauges. So how accurate are they, and where do you put them so that you know that you're getting an accurate reading?
So two aspects to this. One is I want to plug this group called COCHRAS, which is COCHRAS or something. It's a community group that does rainfall measurements. And so they have a recommended rain gauge that you get and you put it out. The main thing is you want to make sure you put it away from any obstructions that might block rain from falling on it or from bouncing off something and getting into the rain gauge.
Right.
So you got to make sure it's nice and big and open. And those rain gauges are very accurate. They've been around for very, very, very hundreds of years, 100 years anyway. And so that's an accurate measurement of it. Again, depending on where you put it, for sure. And I've been doing that now for several years, well, probably a decade or more.
Okay.
I don't do it in the wintertime. Because you get rain in there, it's likely to freeze, and they're made of plastic, so they crack. There they also have a process on how you measure a snowfall. So again, there you want a very flat surface that's in the open, but not too shielded a little bit so the winds don't just take it away. And you make snow depth measurements in multiple places to do that.
Okay.
Now, there are a variety of also weather stations that you can buy from different organizations. One of them is La Crosse. That's the brand name. And I think it's made in Wisconsin. And so I got that. I had an older one that didn't measure rain, or it didn't measure it very well. And I ran my boat into it and broke it. So I had to get a new one.
Okay.
And
so
put
you
it in a better spot.
I take it you were backing up your boat?
I was backing up and not paying attention. I was like, oh,
like, do you live on a lake? I was confused there, Steve.
And that actually has, it's called the dipping gauge. So it falls into this little gathering bucket and falls into this cup. And when that cup gets full, it tips over, empties out, and another cup moves in. and they've calibrated it so that each time that cup tips, it's a certain amount of precipitation.
Okay.
And so I put that right next to my, near my rain gauge, my manual rain gauge. Mm-hmm. And actually the two of them, to my surprise, are actually really accurate.
Okay.
Often less than, differences are generally often less than a tenth of a degree, you know, like 0.05 or something. So
that's not a big difference.
If you don't want to go out and make the measurement all the time, a good weather station with a good rain gauge will also do it. And then it beams it right back to your house.
Nice.
So you can read it in your living room.
Yeah, because you don't want to go out when it's raining or snowing.
Right, yes. If you're participating in Kokoros at 7 a.m., you need to go out there and make that measurement.
Okay. David in Gerward emailed, as a cyclist, he would love to dial in a nice tailwind while planning his route. And he's curious about prevailing wind directions, how Lake Michigan impacts wind, and any hints about the best time of day or season to ride when touring.
Boy, that's a good question. I don't have any input on the best time or season. I think around the big lakes, like Lake Michigan, the things you want to watch for are lake breezes. And so those are pretty well forecast in the summertime in particular, when they'll break out. They usually happen late in the afternoon, and they'll blow from the lake inland. And so you can have a good chance of having a tailwind that way. Now, how far they go, maybe 70 miles. So if he's a real into biking, that might not be long enough for him.
depends on the day, I would assume.
It depends on the day and where their wind direction is coming from.
Right, right.
But the National Weather Service is actually getting really good at its weather forecastings in general, and particular wind speed and directions. And so if I really want to know what the wind speed and direction is going to be because I'm going to row, I'm not a big biker, then, yeah, I'll go to their site, and they're actually pretty accurate.
Okay.
And actually, there are apps now on your phone, because I did this on the rowing again. You know, you could put in the conditions that you want, what weather, you know, obviously not rain for me, you know, what the temperature is, and in rowing, it's more of what is the wind speed and what is the direction. And it'll get the National Weather Service data and tell you, you know, in the coming day, what are the good times to go out and do rowing based on those conditions that you have?
That's so nice. Which app is that?
I don't remember what it is.
Well, thanks for the information.
I've had it for so long, right? You just open it up and look.
And there it is, right? Yeah, it's like phone numbers.
Yeah, right.
Well, it's out there, so.
It's out there. You know what? As we look at the next caller here, I'll
okay, that sounds
look at what
good.
It is.
Lee emailed us in to ask, are there any consequences about the, or consensus, I'm sorry, about the North Atlantic current and the possibility that it might be slowing or stopping in the next century or less?
The app, I think, is the Weather Underground app that'll do that.
The Weather Underground app.
The Weather Underground app.
Oh, that's really cool.
That.
Okay. Got that.
And I think, again, with regard to the Atlantic current, a lot of that prediction, again, is one, do we need the data to actually do it? I think we understand the physics of the circulations of the oceans pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
The main issue with how that's going to change in the future is associated with the ice pack. And here I'm not just talking about Greenland, but the Arctic ice sheet as well. As that melts, that's going to change the Arctic current, and we'll see the Gulf Stream current and where that's going.
Okay. Jeremiah sent us an email. Any new research on sprites from lightning in the upper atmosphere?
Yeah, so sprites, I'm sure there are. Sprites, for those who may not know, there are a lot of interesting things associated with lightning, with thunderstorms. And sprites are these things that will shoot out the top. And so if you're underneath the thunderstorm, you're probably not going to see them because they're shooting out the top and heading up out of space, sort of, or into the upper atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not aware of any new research that has occurred. And again, that's not because it's not happening. I'm just not sure what it is. I will say this, there's a lot of good satellites that better capabilities are up there. So I'm sure we're collecting more data on when sprites occur and how high they go.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's probably some
Yeah, I've never heard of that term before, so that's great. We are talking weather with John Ackerman, an emeritus professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences. If you've got a question, send it to us at talk@wpr.org. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, and we're talking about weather. I've been told that the phones are now working, so we have about 10 minutes left where we can maybe get your call. That's 800-642-1234. And just to let you know, we have lots of fun Halloween stuff coming up on the show this week. Wednesday, we're going to take a look at what nature does best in the dark. And then on Thursday, it's time to talk about the history of Halloween and the history of horror at the movies. So right now, like I said, we're talking weather, so let us know if you have any questions. Deb in Wausau emailed us. She's looking for clarification on your comments on weather modification and cloud seeding. She sent a few peer review articles about cloud seeding to enhance precipitation.
Yeah, so this again was a big thing in the 70s and the 80s as we began to understand more about what causes precipitation, particularly snowfall, that there was this idea that in order to get clouds form, you need nuclei. You need things for the water vapor to condense onto. And so the idea was, well, if we can put in the right kind of particles, we can help a cloud form. Or once a cloud forms, in order to get precipitation, you need some big particles in there so that they can collide with the other ones and then fall out. So the other question was, can we put bigger particles in there? And one way to do that was to put ice nuclei in there to, again, to enhance the seeding and to make the precipitation. There was a lot of research going on in the 70s and the 80s. I don't think there's much research going on right now because, again, I think as we collected data, we began to realize these systems are really, really big. And there's a lot of energy in there, and the little things that we can do really aren't going to work. Now, having said that, in the late 70s, I was at Colorado State doing some work there, and the ski slopes were very interested in generating more snowfall. And so they had a whole seeding program where they would put silver iodide into the clouds, hoping that that would lead to more snowfall. And so there was a big experiment to do that. They randomly would seed clouds on particular days and then measure snowfall afterwards. And after they did that for a couple of years and they did the analysis, sure enough, it turned out that snowfall did increase on the days that they seeded, which was a really big finding because now it's like, okay, this is really going to help ski resorts. A couple of years later, somebody reanalyzed the data and they said, yes, that was true, except the days in which they did seed, it just so happened, and again, this was all random, that the winds were upslope. So the winds were coming upslope anyway, and upslope winds are going to generate more snowfall than other kinds of winds. Mm-hmm. And so when they randomized and took that effect out, then there wasn't any impact at all. Okay. It was kind of an interesting thing because it was a really big thing in the late 70s, and then all of a sudden it was like, oh, wait a minute, that... It goes back to, again, what do we know and what do we don't know?
Sure. Let's go to Bob in Clay Banks. Go ahead, Bob.
Hi, Dylan, Steve. Thanks for having the show. Steve, I've got two thermometers. One's the old red liquid ones, and the other is a La Crosse. And I put the sensor for the La Crosse on the north side of my garage, and the red liquid one is just outside a window on the north side of the house. And we get different readings, and sometimes it's kind of strange because sometimes the La Crosse will show things warmer than the other one, and it's, you know, kind of like I say, on the north side of the house. So,
yeah, you know, it's funny you should bring that up because I have the same problem, and I have a La Crosse system. I put my thermometer on. Out by my rain gauge, because I wanted to have the rain gauge measurement out there as well. And I put it in the facing north. And what I noticed in the summertime is that the temperature would all of a sudden increase. As we were approaching sunset. And what was happening, I'm pretty sure, is that the way that I had it, even though I thought it was very well protected, the sun was hitting it at certain points. And that just shot the temperature up. And then when the sun moved a little bit further, an hour later, the temperature would come back down. So my plan, and I haven't done this yet, is to put a shield on that west-facing side so that I can assure that it's in shadow all the time. So you might look at that, see where the sun is. If your thermometer is always warmer than there all day long, then there's something else that's going on.
Could be a reflection off of something, too.
It might be, but again, I would think that that would be then associated with where the position of the sun is in order to get that solar energy on it. So I'm hoping that's what it is, because if it's not, then again, even though I keep basically saying the La Crosse system's really good, then maybe the thermometer's not.
Yeah. Okay, Bob, good luck. Russ in Belleville, go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. First, a disclaimer, I'm not a climate denier, but I remember a few years ago I read something where someone had a theory that you would have a period of warming before you had an ice age, and that would warm and melt the ice, shut off the Gulf Stream, up, you know, in the Northern Hemisphere, and that would be how an ice age initiated. What do you think about that process?
Yeah, you know, there were a lot of good theories, and again, this goes back to the current of the Gulf Stream and what's going to happen when that ice sheet melts. It's definitely going to change the Gulf Stream. What it's going to do, I think there's modeling theories about what that's going to happen. And I'm guessing in the past, the position of that Gulf Stream was very much associated with how much ice we had on the globe and whether or not it was an ice age or not. I don't think that's going to be applicable to current situations, primarily because of the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and the general global warming that we're seeing. What I think we're really going to see the impact is downstream of the Gulf Stream. So those countries downstream that are really keeping it or have it weather advantages, if you want to think of it in terms of more milder weather because of the Gulf Stream. If that moves, what will happen to them? Will they get more variability in their rain or more weather? That part I don't know.
And you're talking about states like Carolinas?
No. So further down, different countries. So
that far down.
Norway, areas like that, where the Gulf Stream is really helping moderate their weather.
All right. Thank you for that question, Russ. Tammy called but couldn't stay with us. Could you describe how the UV index is measured, and why is a UV index of 1 or 2 still pretty sunny?
So I don't know the details. What the UV index is telling us is how much ultraviolet radiation is down at the surface, and that'll be a function primarily of cloud cover, also time of day as well. I don't remember if a low UV index is good or a high UV index is bad. I would think a high UV index is not as good as a low, and I say that not as somebody who wants to have a tan.
does, by the way.
It's because a lot of people who are very fair skinned and ultraviolet radiation, particularly if they were younger and they didn't put protective coatings on their skin, are now dealing with skin cancer as well. So it wouldn't surprise me, even in a cloudy condition, you could have higher UVs or moderate UV indexes, and that's because the clouds, if they're thin, are just going to scatter the radiation. They're not going to absorb it, and that scattering will illuminate potentially more areas than just the direct beam from the sun.
Okay. Real quick question before we have to go. Lorraine in Green Bay is looking for a good, reliable weather station for her husband for Christmas. Hope he's not listening. One that he could connect to Weather Underground. Any ideas?
I would go to the Weather Underground site and see if they have recommendations. As I say, I have the La Crosse system. It seems to work really well. I don't remember what the price ranges are. But there are a number of good companies now that make good rain gauges. And I think the big part is where you're going to put it.
There you
make
go.
Sure it's in a good spot. and you're not going to run into it and break it.
That's right. Words of wisdom. Thank you so much, Steve, for being with us today.
Thank you.
Steve Ackerman is the former Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison. We thank him for being with us. I want to thank our team today, Clara Neipert, Joel Patenaud, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins, and our usual host, of course, Larry Mueller. I'm executive producer Jill Nadeau. I really appreciate you being with us today. Enjoy the rest of it.